Oh, Latimer, it's beautiful. But who does it belong to?
I'm not at liberty to give the owner's name, but I can say that he is a legitimate businessman who has a vested interest in New York property.
And does he know we have his yacht?
Oh, yes, ma'am. He is not the sort of man one crosses. He has something of a temper.
In that case, we'd better make sure we return it in one piece.
Yes, ma'am. His very words were, not a single scratch.
Well, if we're careful, I'm sure it will all be fine.
Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman. There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril.
Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't just had your favourite TV show cancelled. I'm Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea there for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and of course, a nice cup of tea. This yacht really is the most beautiful vessel I have ever seen. Everything is polished to perfection, from the brass fittings to the amazing honey-coloured deck. It has every comfort one could possibly need at sea, from a cosy private cinema to a cocktail bar. There's even a small dance floor. A couple of the cabins below are locked, but the rest of the yacht is ours to enjoy. Pull up a chair and get comfortable. The weather forecast is excellent, and the ocean view is simply divine.
I'm sorry to disturb you, ma'am, but your guest has arrived, a Mr. Sebastian de Castel.
Oh, splendid. Let's see his calling card. Sebastian de Castel, abnormally fortunate dilettante.
Rather cheap cardstock, ma'am.
Latimer, that's a bit judgmental.
Precisely, ma'am. One should always stand to be judged on the quality of one's calling card.
It feels a little strange. Oh, the wind caught it. No, wait. I do believe it's actually a tiny flying carpet.
Oh, no. That's even worse.
Don't be horrible, Latimer. Go and help him on board.
Very good, ma'am.
For those of you who don't know, Sebastian de Castel is the author of the acclaimed swashbuckling fantasy series, The Greatcoats. His debut novel, Traitor's Blade, was shortlisted for both the 2014 Goodreads Choice Award for Best Fantasy and the Gemmell Morningstar Award for Best Debut.
Mr. Sebastian de Castel, ma'am.
Hello, Sebastian. Do come and sit down. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. There's a lovely breeze coming off the Pacific there, isn't there?
Isn't it beautiful? It just takes the edge off the heat from the sun. It's just perfect. Would you care for some tea?
I would love some tea.
And how do you take your tea?
Usually in a cup with some form of sugar product to sweeten it, unless it's a berry tea.
No. This is proper English breakfast tea.
Oh, okay. Well, then I'll take it just the exact way that a proper English lad would do.
Oh, marvellous. I'll add a dash of milk for you as well. I'll pour. And I was wondering if you would like a slice of lemon and poppy seed cake.
That sounds both delicious and extremely healthy.
So I just want to check before we get into the serious business of tea and cake that you're not allergic to chickens.
No. Chickens are, you know, the unsung heroes of our society, so to be allergic to them would be improper.
Marvellous. I'm so glad. Well, they'll just be over there in their little pen. We didn't want them to accidentally just flutter off and go into the sea. That would never do. So in my invitation, I asked you to bring a curio with you. What have you decided to bring today?
I brought my tiny travelling wooden elephant.
Adorable.
Yes, he's a spectacular specimen of his breed. Small wooden elephants being a, you know, not spectacularly known breed. It's just a small tiny wooden elephant that is always in my travel case, and 90% of the time I don't think about it, but that's only because he's doing such an excellent job of protecting me from demons and warfare and any other form of conflict or danger in the world. He's especially good with pirates, although that's never been tested.
Oh, Well, I'm sure we won't need to test that today.
Thank heavens.
I mean, look, the horizon is clear. There's nothing to see except the odd albatross. It's just marvellous here. So he's kept you safe for how many years now?
Probably about 20 years.
Oh, wow. Where did you get him from?
My wife and I were traveling, and when we bought our house, we're decorating as one does, you know, trying to decorate on a budget. And you always want to feel like you have something that looks vaguely like art. And she ended up selecting this strange thing that looked like a combination of a tall, thin obelisk, like a needle on the back of this elephant. And so that went in our bathroom. And that elephant has served as an excellent protector against evil spirits and whatever else may come. And so we saw a small wooden elephant. I think we were in Egypt at the time, mm-hmm. Which is an odd place to find small wooden elephants, but you can pretty much find anything there. I just bought it to put it in my little travel case. And it's funny because one of the things, I mean, I travel a lot and always have, and so does my wife. And one of the things that we've noticed is that having any tiny thing that has no purpose, no obvious outward purpose when you're traveling, but which is a symbol of home, is remarkably reassuring when you get those periodic moments where you're in the hotel and you can't even remember which hotel it is, and you're not quite sure which city it is, and you're exhausted and jet lagged. And then you just sort of have this little thing that exists there in that place only because it's a representation of your home.
I have a very small teddy bear that my little boy gave to me before, I think, one of my first trips to a US convention. And he said that I could take it with me so that when I wanted to have a cuddle, there was someone there to cuddle me. So that's my little one. I totally know what you mean. It's a really important connection to home. In your author bio at the front of the Greatcoat books, it says that 4 hours into your first dig, you realized how much you hated archaeology. And I hope you don't mind me asking this, but was it the fieldwork specifically that you hated, or was there a steady kind of falling out of love experience over the course of your degree?
It was the fieldwork specifically. Like a lot of people, probably especially like a lot of writers, I tended to wander around between, 20-odd different possible majors, in North America, you major in something. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was everything from communications to psychology to anthropology. And, eventually I sort of landed on archaeology. And I remember the faculty advisor at the time saying, oh, well, there's a 3-week dig you could go and do because you have a course requirement to do either the major lab course or a dig course, basically, as a practical experience. And at the time, it wasn't convenient for me to be traveling. And I said, well, do you think it's a good idea? And he said, yeah, you should really jump into it if you're going to do if you're going to have a degree in archaeology. And I said, no, I think it'll be fine. So I did the lab course. And then I was right up at graduation, and right then and there had to go and onto a dig for a final sort of course in Sutton Hoo, of all places.
Oh, wow.
Which, of course, is the source of many wonderful photos of things that look like they'd be really fun to dig up.
Yeah.
But, of course, by the time I was there, everything had been dug up. You were basically out there in the sun with a toothbrush. And the thing is archaeology is it's the example I use of the difference between the idea of a thing and the doing of a thing.
Uh-huh.
So in archaeology, the idea is amazing. The idea is adventure, it's history, it's investigating the past. But the reality of it is it's camping. It's a lot of camping. And you're out in the sun and you're kind of digging, doing slow work. And often, this is really just when you're taking that particular position on a dig, but that's where, a lot of archaeologists spend a great deal of time. It's almost like knitting. Like, there's people that love knitting and they could knit for days, and there's people that can sit there and they can just very, very slowly pull apart at the dirt, covering a layer of more dirt. But for me, it was actual torture. Whereas in the world of music, especially live performance, for example, a lot of people, the idea of that is it's about being on stage and people adoring you and all of this stuff, but they actually don't enjoy the doing of it. Whereas for me, I love the doing of music. I find that energizing and enjoyable. I mean, I still do it all the time. So that was what I discovered. So yes, I was literally 4 hours into that dig when I discovered the sheer magnitude of my hatred for the doing of archaeology. So overpowering was it that, and I hate to admit this publicly, but I told them that I had received a phone call from my university instructing me that I had made a mistake and I had to come back and that my dig course was canceled. So I wouldn't be getting credit and had to go home. And they were so nice. They offered to call the university. I said, no, they're so angry. You don't want to do that.
Oh, no. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Well, I guess, well, no, actually, there's no way to make that sound good. That sounds absolutely terrible. That must have been quite scary, suddenly thinking, uh-oh, what do I do? Or did you know what you wanted to do instead?
No, I had no clue. I've never really had a clue. I've just sort of gone from one thing that seemed exciting and that drew me in to some other thing that became exciting and drew me in. And so, you know, my career sort of spanned, you know, a lot of different fields. I usually get kind of excited by the possibility and the challenge of something. Mm-hmm. You know, and ultimately writing is no different. You just get excited by the possibility and the challenge, and you wonder, like, could I really do this? And what would I have to do? And so that's what I tend to pursue. And alas, poor archaeology did not quite fit that bill. There were, in fact, no bullwhips offered. And they weren't even impressed by my hat.
Yeah, there is some bad archaeology in those films. Don't get me wrong. I mean, Indiana Jones was the first man that I ever crushed on in my entire life. There is a very special place in my heart for that. But no archaeology was harmed in the making of those movies. Or in fact, the opposite. I think archaeology as a subject probably was harmed greatly with all these people going into it thinking, I'm going to be like Indiana Jones. I hope not.
I kid you not. I spoke to, back in the day, to my faculty advisor who said that at the launch of every Indiana Jones movie, enrollment doubled.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yep. My goodness. Oh, those people must have been so disappointed.
Well, some of them discovered lots of things that they do. I mean, it is a fascinating field. It's a challenging field because it positions itself as a social science, whereas a lot of people see it more as a sort of an art in that, you know, as a social science, you are working entirely of evidence. Mm. Whereas when we think of history, we're often dealing with the speculation of things, with the interpretation of events that we know of. So there's a famous quote, I can't remember the exact quote, but it's something along the lines of, as an archaeology, I am a scientist with my feet firmly in the present, looking towards the past.
Yeah, interesting.
And that was in answer to the notion of archaeologists, quote, studying the past. So his response was, no, we study the evidence that exists today and we interpret the past from that evidence.
Mm. I can't remember who talked about it online, but there was somebody who was in a lecture and they were talking about this kind of first tool that seemed to measure 28 days. And they were talking about, you know, speculating why man would have done this and, you know, how incredible it was that man started to do it. And then the lecturer said, but let's just pause a moment and think about why would a man want to measure 28 days? What about the possibility that there was a woman involved in this and it just been completely, you know, forgotten or not even considered that a woman may have made one of the first tools to measure time and all this kind of stuff. And it was a really nice kind of reminder of how our current society can give us blind spots in the way that we interpret the past. I thought it was a really nice story to kind of always remind us to think past what is embedded in us culturally today and geographically, you know, it affects us as well. Was that something that was discussed a lot in your degree?
Well, there actually are quite a number of prominent women archaeologists, sort of always have been. In fact, one of my instructors for my intro to archaeology course was Brute Galdikas, who was one of the three famous anthropologists. They're known as, they refer to as the students of Louis Leakey, who was, of course, very famous as well. But she was the one who studied the orangutans. I'm struggling to remember the names of the other two women who are both prominent, one with chimpanzees and one with gorillas. So Gorillas in the Mist was the movie with Sigourney Weaver that was made about, and I apologize for forgetting her name.
That's fine. I'm terrible with names, all names, Bernard.
Yeah, Bernard Dickey.
No, I've remembered yours, don't worry.
There you go. But actually, one of the things that you mentioned that's it's absolutely true. One of the interesting problems for modern day, what I would say, middle class liberals like myself, you know, who are quite proud of their, you know, of our liberal views, is that you can actually hold very deeply felt philosophical convictions about issues of, you know, fairness and working from evidence-based governance and all of these kind of good things. But the internal narratives that spring up when you look at any given new situation are still the same ones that were held by people who had very different philosophical views. I mean, it's a terrible way of saying, like, you can actually very much self-identify as someone who is absolutely committed to equal rights, you know, in all contexts. But often when you look at something exactly as you've described, some object from the past, the first thought that goes into your head is the same thought that went into the head of, or that goes into the head of, I don't know, I don't want to say Donald Trump because I don't know what's in his head, but you know
what
I mean?
Do we want to know?
are sort of the views, we can hold views that are much more sophisticated than our actual instinctual narratives.
Yeah. Coming away from that to your writing career, I was wondering if there's anything in your career as a writer that you now look back and laugh at that at the time you thought was absolutely terrible.
Oh, that's interesting. You know, there really isn't. I've been sort of almost impossibly lucky most of the way around. So I haven't had any of those experiences where you're just mortified. You know, I mean, I suppose you always live in fear of, you know, of the negative reviews, but I'm not sure that that's what you're leaning towards.
Any kind of experience, really. I'm quite interested with people who have had several books out where, you know, you're getting into the stride of it and the starry-eyedness is fading and perspective on things, you know?
Actually, I did, in fact, have three experiences all in a row that quite mortified me at the time, because my natural tendency is to be a little bit flippant and a bit of a smartass. And I was flying to Toronto. I was just about to sign my first book deal, the one for the Great Coats. So this 4-book deal out of the blue. My publisher is, you know, Jo Fletcher. She's this incredibly eminent editor and publisher from the UK. My Canadian publisher was this wonderful editor, Adrian Kerr from Penguin. And if you're a Canadian boy, you know, what you dream of in life is having a penguin symbol on the spine of your book. Mm-hmm. And of course, my wonderful agent and her husband. And so I was meeting all three of them, I think, virtually hours apart. And in each encounter, I managed to tell a joke that was so mind-numbingly inappropriate that it wasn't a question of how my career was going to end, but simply which of the three available options was going to be applied. Fortunately, it turns out that in the world of science fiction and fantasy, there are authors who are even more prone to putting their foot in their mouth than I am. So they were quite gentle with me.
Well, they were buying your books, not not your ability to make people laugh in person.
I think I literally said to Adrienne, who's absolutely the most wonderful person on the planet, I think I was literally just meeting her. We just shook hands and she said, "Welcome to Penguin." And I said, "Well, you know, my agent Heather has said that a publishing deal is like a marriage. And so since Penguin will be publishing my books as well as other publishers, welcome to my harem."
Oh my God.
There are so many reasons why that is not a smart or good thing to say to the senior commercial fiction editor for Penguin.
No.
Yeah. So it's one of the reasons why I tend to be quite... I try to be more careful now because I've been so lucky to not actually get the appropriate punishment for the stupid things that I sometimes say.
Oh, wow. That's a real clanger. Well done. Now, if there was one thing you could stop Hollywood filmmakers from doing ever again, what would it be?
This is going to sound very political, and I swear that it is not at all political. I wish that they would stop the process of casting Egyptian gods with Scotsmen.
Yes.
You know, most often it's the recasting, of course, of people of color or people from other cultures, you know, with famous or modestly famous North American actors. As I say, it sounds like it's a political statement. I mean, I think it's a pretty logical statement. It doesn't require you to be particularly left-leaning to think it. But actually, part of it is just it makes those movies so unbearably unsatisfying to watch. When you want to go and see something and you're like, oh, this is so fantastic. It's going to have Egyptian gods in it. And then you're watching these actors who completely, through no fault of their own, remove that illusion, remove that sense of connecting with anything interesting. Even if you weren't going to connect with anything real and legitimate, you know, because it's a movie in the first place, it breaks the illusion. For me, it's such a fundamental mistake of storytelling. That I wish they would stop doing it.
Yeah, I totally agree. If you could use dark arts to steal the power of one other author, what would it be and why?
It would be Neil Gaiman, and it would be his ability to write pretty much anything he wants of any size, in any format, at any time, and still churn out something that is both wonderful in and of itself and is received with such tremendous acclaim.
Yes. Though it was lovely, I saw him do a interview like on a stage in Bath a couple of years ago, I think it was. I don't know. Time is all blurring into one now. It was really, really lovely listening to him talking about all of the things he catastrophically failed at. Mm-hmm. And it was so refreshing because he was almost kind of like demigod status by the point of going to see him. And it was like, well, whatever he does, it kind of turns to gold. And it was so reassuring and comforting to hear so many things that he had tried just completely fail or get so far and then be dropped. And to gain that perspective of the 10-year-long overnight success was really marvellous. Mm-hmm. He's such a lovely bloke, hasn't gone to his head. At least he doesn't give the impression of it having done so.
It's actually funny because I saw him here in Vancouver with a friend doing a reading, and it was a pretty large theater. So it's a huge number of people. And my friend expressed some mild disappointment afterwards. He said, you know, he seemed like he was embracing the adulation and just really, you know, it almost felt a bit arrogant to him. And it's interesting because I took away a different one, which is that when he is speaking to a large group of people, he is giving them what everyone wants is to create the sort of semi-mythical Neil Gaiman. And so together, he and the audience create this kind of performance of the ever witty, ever insightful, ever gentle and generous author that can do no wrong. You know, to my mind, he's completely sincere, but it's that sort of that performance aspect, which is something that the audience really wants to have as well. And so it's interesting to me that I get the sense that he's always creating that opportunity for people. You know, if you want to have this, create this sense of wonder and myth around a writer, we can do that together for a while.
That's a really interesting point. I think it's really interesting when people reach the level of success that he has, that it's actually very difficult to tell what a person is really like, because so much of our appraisal is always going to be tainted, I think, by our own projection and transference and all kinds of things that are going on, where, you know, we may have our own envy or our own jealousy that we could then, you know, twist our own perceptions with, that they are just kind of lapping it up, or they're so full of themselves, when in fact that's us being unable to cope with the fact that they're more successful. And that person is the same person in these situations, and yet all of those different interpretations of them, which have nothing to do with them, they have everything to do with the minds of the audience. I find it fascinating, and I also find it very scary as well, because when you are that person, how do you deal with it? This is not a fear I've ever had to face, or probably will never have to face, but I find it really interesting.
Well, I think we all do actually run up against it, in it just at different orders of magnitude, because you know, when someone sends you a fan letter for a book, your response is going to be interpreted by them in their context and not in the context of, and I think that's one of the dangers actually that we face as writers, is that we can be not very famous and therefore feel like, well, therefore, you know, I'm just a regular person. It doesn't, you know, I'm not subject to, you know, I'm not a celebrity. But in fact, there is always going to be someone for whom the things that we say, for whom we do look like celebrities. You know what I mean? I meet writers all the time who are starting out or who've been doing it for a long time. And, you know, I'm sure you've been on the same kind of panels where you're asked to talk about, you know, here, you know, give the best writing advice or tell people the five things they should never do. And I'm always terrified by that because I'm afraid that someone will forget the most important lesson of writing, which is that nobody else but you knows anything.
Yep. And you can only ever figure it out for what works for you yourself. Well, I always preface any kind of thing like that with, well, this is what I've discovered working for me and it's different for every single person. But when you see all those people like leaning forwards, hoping to hear that magic thing, it's like, oh, you darlings, it's not like that. You're not going to hear it from us. It's really hard.
Absolutely. And what terrifies me is all too often I feel like I'm watching other people, and maybe I fall into it myself, speaking with this air of sort of confidence, kind of almost cavalier certainty, and saying, well, you know, never write a book about elves and vampires. That's a waste of time. You know, nobody wants to publish those, or that's the kind of writing you do when you're an amateur, or those things. And I'm always terrified about those kind of things, because actually maybe someone's greatest book is going to be about vampires and elves. In fact, maybe I'll go write that book next. That sounds like it. Now I'm thinking it's actually not a bad idea, because you've got two different kinds of immortals in a sense, and you know, one that preys on other beings for that immortality and one that seemingly doesn't, but maybe actually in a way elves do prey on the opportunities of other beings. So so that's the next series.
So like vampire elf, what, buddy cop movie kind of thing, like partnership investigating crimes or something else completely?
I was thinking more of one of those sort of, well, maybe it could feature buddy cops. So I think that could work. But I was thinking more sort of something where you go through most of the book thinking that the vampires are the evil ones. And then as you start to realize the impact of the elves upon the world, you see that actually they're either just as evil or even more so.
Yeah, that appeals.
You know, that sort of phenomenon that you're talking about of how people sort of perceive the things that we say and construct it. I think also part of that is that, you know, we all have these different sides of ourselves, and we present those in what we feel is the appropriate context. And they're all genuine. You know, sometimes I sound like a nice, thoughtful, sensible person. And that's genuine, but it's highly incomplete, because there's other times where I suppose I should have told this in reverse, because now I do sound like a jerk. You know, there's times where I sound like an arrogant, pessimistic, cynical jerk who likes the sound of his own voice. And I am also that person. I think one of the reasons I knew I was completely in love with my wife was because the person I was around her was a person that I tended to like more.
Oh, that is so romantic.
Huh. See, sometimes I can even be romantic.
Oh, that's lovely. Perhaps in tangent to this, my next question is, would you rather be able to see only the good in people or only the bad?
Only the good.
So why do you say that?
Well, because if you're going to choose between two wrong things, you may as well choose the one that's most likely to let you see the possibility of a better future than the one that eliminates any possible good future.
And would probably hopefully be less likely to cause extreme depression.
Yes. Also, I think I fundamentally believe that on balance, there is more good in people than bad. And I think my experiences in life have certainly borne that out.
Mm. Yes, I would agree. So whenever we have a guest at the Tea Lair, we like to ask lovely people online who aren't able to be with us on this luxury yacht in the middle of the Pacific having tea, if there's a question that they would ask if they were able. And the splendid Mark Aplin of Fantasy Faction has a very good question. He would like to ask, was the addition of so many excellent women in the second book a decision you made on reflection of the first book, due to demands from fans or something that just occurred naturally?
That's a very good question.
Mm.
So when I first wrote Traitor's Blade, I was very much writing from the intimate first-person view of Falchio as a character, who's a character that I love. He has lots of wonderful qualities, but he also has any number of flaws. And some of those are flaws that I share, and some of those are flaws that I hope I don't share. But I chose not to sort of mask those, because sometimes we try to write characters, when we try to write well-rounded characters, what we do is we simply give them acceptable flaws rather than actual flaws.
Mm-hmm.
So one of Falchio's actual flaws is a tendency to feel that it's his role in life to protect women at all costs. The defining moment of his life was the failure to protect his wife. And the consequence of that has been that everything he's done since then, in one form or another, has been an attempt to somehow remove that event. Mm-hmm. And so he tends to view a lot of the female characters as either enemies or people to be protected. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes that comes out in all kinds of different ways. And throughout the series, even though Falchio himself does not necessarily get that much better at addressing it, other people are much more conscious of it. And so to kind of expose that, because again, I think that it's a character flaw, and it's something that, you know, that makes him who he is. And it's, for me, part of what makes him interesting.
Mm-hmm.
To do that, we need to see what that looks like. And so some of the characters that he encounters along the way become naturally, you know, as he's forced to see who they are versus who he thinks that they are, we start to see more depth. And especially in a world like Tristia, which is an incredibly corrupt world that is not remotely kind by and large to anyone, but has a lot of the same sort of archaic views about gender and gender roles that we as a sort of Western society have had, it tends to also breed a lot of very powerful women. But Falchio doesn't necessarily know that at the start of the very first book. He doesn't necessarily see it that way. And so it takes time before he comes to that. And in fact, it's funny because I think not long ago, somebody was complaining about the female duelists in one of the books. And I don't think this was necessarily coming from any antagonism towards women, but this person's position was, you know, well, it's not realistic. You know, the real facts are, you know, the usual sort of things about, you know, men's bodies are built for conflict and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
and so I pointed out that actually the funny thing is that there are all of these actually amazing female duelists in our history who most of us don't, we're just not aware of. And it kind of boggles the mind that some of the stories aren't told. Like I'm trying to remember her name. She was originally an actress who became known as La Yagrorina, which I apologize to anyone of Spanish descent for butchering the name, but it was the Lady Jaguar basically. And she was trained by this amazing fencer and duelist, and she ended up making her living dueling men in public events.
Oh, that's so awesome.
Yeah, and she was absolutely stunningly good at it. And so when I read about something like that, you know, it's hard not to want to use it, right? It's just so fascinating, right?
Yeah.
And so you bring those in so that, you know, that's why you tend to see more of the female characters coming into their own as the series progresses. It's because Falchio as a character, you know, is becoming more aware over time. And that's not me trying to bring diversity into the writing, not that that wouldn't be a good thing. That's simply me trying to deal with the natural need for drama and conflict. I'm always writing Falchio. This is always a book, you know, this is always a series that's being written from a very male perspective. But that's not necessarily a bad thing, because it's also, I think, an opportunity for me as a writer to explore that kind of gradually growing and changing perspective as the character deals with more of the real world rather than simply the world as he has sort of grown up to see it.
Excellent. So the second question I have is from a gentleman called Stephen Poor, and he would like to know what your greatcoat's name would be.
I was thinking about that. I think it's André de Moncrief.
Okay. You had definitely been thinking about that in advance.
Well, because we've done that, there's a competition that comes up every once in a while. Joe Fletcher Books define the rules by which one identifies one's greatcoat's name.
Ah.
And it's, I think, your the name of your first school followed by your grandmother's maiden name.
Oh.
Grandmother on your mother's side, maiden name. So in my case, it would be Saint André de Moncrief.
That's very nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds good.
I think he'd be a good character in a book. I think I'll put him in.
The chickens over there, they're quite unusual. They're very, very musically talented. And I like to ask my friends who come to take tea what the theme tune of their life would be so that we can ask the chickens to give us a special rendition. So I would like to ask you the same question. If you could choose a theme tune for your life, what would it be so we can ask the chickens to sing it for you?
Well, now, my choice is partly influenced by these particular chickens, I have to confess, because I don't know your particular chickens, but they have a slight Norwegian look to a few of them. And a lot of people don't know that the massive worldwide Norwegian hit Take On Me by A-ha, the keyboard line at the beginning was originally composed by a family of Norwegian chickens. So the opportunity to hear that wonderfully classic pop tune performed in its original, with its original instrument, which is to say the chicken, is too good to pass up.
Well, when you put it like that, definitely. Now, little chickens, could you sing Take On Me by A-ha, please? And there they go.
I think the word's verklempt. That was just, it was beautiful.
Would you like a handkerchief?
That's very kind of you. Thank you.
Oh, well done, chickens.
You hope to one day hear a song like that performed in its original Norwegian chicken format, but you just don't think it's going to happen. And then it does.
It's these moments that make life sweet.
Yes.
Well, once you've had a moment to collect yourself, I was wondering if you could tell me what things you've got coming out soon. Am I right in thinking that book 3 is very, very soon to come out, if not already?
Saint's Blood, which is the third book in the Greatcoats series, is out in the United Kingdom and in the various Commonwealth markets other than Canada. It comes out in the United States and Canada on June 7th. And yeah, I'm very excited for people to read it. It was literally the hardest thing I've ever done was writing that book.
Really?
Yeah, it was impossibly hard.
Why was that?
I think because as a writer, I tend to follow the drama wherever it sort of leads me, which tends to build up a lot of threads. And then you really feel like you have to make all those threads tie together well. So finding the right way to configure that story, I've never done as much rewriting and revision as I did with Saint's Blood. And I think also because one of the things which I'm sure you've experienced as well, and a lot of writers probably experience, is when you have a series, the first book is sort of yours, but the second book and the third book and the fourth book, all of a sudden there's all of these people that really actually care about what happens. You're not writing to their expectations, but you are trying to fulfill what to me feels like an obligation or a duty to give them the great and surprising story that somehow makes sense in all that world. You know, it's funny because as a writer, you sort of feel like, well, you know, I can have this character say or do this thing if I want, because it's my character. Except that once you have a lot of readers out there, they know those characters. Sometimes people ask me questions or make comments about one of the characters in the books, and I sometimes have to go back and look it up. Because they know some of these things, you know, better than I do, which was not at all something I expected to happen. And it's incredibly gratifying. For me, it means a tremendous amount of thinking and working and trying to get it right. I'm working on Tyrant's Throne, which is the fourth and final volume in the series right now. And it is proving to be as difficult as Saint's Blood was. I keep expecting that one day it's just going to get easier. And I'm told by my wonderful editor, Joe Fletcher, that I've been fooling myself.
Yeah. Yeah, it's I know exactly what you mean with the Split World series. I wrote the first book completely with several drafts, and the first draft of the second book before the first one came out. And then I was writing the third whilst all of the kind of the publicity was hyping up and everything like that. They were brought out very close together. And it was a very different experience writing the third book. It felt almost like there were people sitting on my shoulder as I was writing it who would got very excited about the first one. And now there's been a 2-year gap between books 3 and 4. And so I was writing book 4, where I knew that there were many, many, many people who were waiting and had been waiting a long time for this book and were very excited about it. And you're right, it does feel like an obligation, a responsibility. You don't want to let people down. So yeah, I completely understand that. And now in a situation where I've just run a great big LARP with people playing mm-hmm. characters in those books, and they are all now so super, super ultra invested in those particular characters who they have been for a night. Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to come to the point where I write book 5 and I'm going to be thinking about those players, and they're going to be the ones in my mind. And it's a really interesting experience, like a whole new level of obligation, because it's not just the readers, it's also the amazing role players who were those people. And like, I really hope they like what I'm doing with the character that I planned years ago. You know, that. So yeah, I don't think that is going to get any easier. Sorry. Yeah.
There does come an interesting point where you stop thinking of the series as these books that I'm writing, and you start thinking of them 20 years from now. And that's something that's a thought that's been obsessing me lately, perhaps inappropriately so. But I think about, will people be wanting to read these books 20 years from now? 20 years from now, will people think that they're kind of classics of a rejuvenation of swashbuckling adventure? Or will they just have been books that were solely of their moment and kind of came and went? And it's a really possibly egocentric thing to think of, but it really does sort of happen, isn't it? That there's a point where you start to think of it not so much as books, but as a series, as a work that will be complete someday.
Yeah, and will you feel personal satisfaction with how that story is completed? Mm-hmm. I mean, that sounds like an immense amount of stress that you're putting on yourself thinking about the books 20 years in the future. That's like, wow, I don't think about them in that sense at all. I can't even conceive of how my works would be regarded 20 years in the future. That sounds, wow, you shouldn't put so much pressure on yourself.
Oh, but it's, you know, it's all good pressure. The thing is, you know, you're trying to decode. I guess I look at it this way. I don't think of myself as a great writer. I'm trying to write great books. And so I'm always looking for whatever thought, whatever process, whatever idea, whatever stressor will help me to find what will make that next scene the best it can possibly be. And that's true of the series, the other series that I'm writing that comes out next year, which is called Spellslinger, which is a 6-book series. It begins as a young adult fantasy series. And I'm constantly obsessing over those questions, and not simply because I'm prone to adding too much stress to myself, but because I'm just looking for what is the thing that will trigger the thought that lets me make this scene 5% better, 2% better. I feel like when I look at books these days, I feel like it's not that hard to get to the 80% mark, you know, in terms of quality, that what we're all struggling for is the next 10 to 20%.
Yeah, I agree with that. But there are so many different axes in which you can measure that as mm-hmm. well. I would find it so utterly paralyzing if I started to ask myself those questions. And I'm fascinated by the fact that it doesn't paralyze you, but motivates you to try harder. I don't feel I need any motivation to try harder. That would just cripple me. Isn't that really interesting?
Yeah, I think part of it actually oddly has to do with the UK covers of the books, which were originally designed by the German publisher, because they look so kind of oddly iconic.
They're beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, I mean, thank you. I didn't make them. on behalf of Bursuwa.de, which is the artists, I thank you. But, you know, I do this thing, which I suspect everybody does, whether they admit it or not, which is, you know, the new book comes in, and the first thing you want to do once you're sort of holding it is put it on the shelf next to the others.
Yep.
And there comes this point where when I'm looking at the books, what I'm really thinking about is all the people that have taken the time to write to me or talk to me at a conference or anything like that, you know, who talk about what they enjoy about the books. And I just start to look at them and wonder about those questions. Like, because the positive feelings I have about the books have to do with how much I like them and how much I, as a reader myself, how they feel to me. And then when that's reinforced by other people liking them, you just have this thing where you're like, well, what do I have to do to make it so that enjoyment or that sense of connection that people feel will still be around 20 years from now? And also, you know, we often read books sometimes that we loved 20 years ago, before, and they don't feel like they hold up as well necessarily. And yet some books do. So I suppose it just comes from some kind of horrible ego, doesn't it?
I don't know. I don't know if you're the same, because this is all getting quite heavy and deep. And I really feel like the next time we're at a convention together, we need to go and sit in the corner and talk about this at like 3 o'clock in the morning when we're really tired and slightly drunk. Something I've been thinking a lot for various real life reasons is, okay, how many books can I write before I die? I don't know when I'm going to die, but I don't have an infinite amount of time. And so I have to pick the books I really, really want to write, because that is what I'm going to leave behind. Have you ever had that thought?
Strangely, I don't, which is interesting. So, because you're thinking about mortality and I'm thinking about immortality.
Yeah, that is really interesting. To be continued. Yes. Over alcohol one day.
Yeah. But
let me just check that. Oh, I'm afraid the teapot is empty. Oh, well, we'll have to continue this conversation at some point in the future. But all that leaves me to say is thank you so much for taking the trouble to fly out to that island, catch that motorboat, and come out to the yacht. It's very kind of you.
It was my absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me. And especially, it's just wonderful to be out on the open seas in beautiful weather, knowing that you're perfectly safe and sound. I don't think I've felt this relaxed in years.
Isn't it just marvelous? It seems your elephant has done its job once again.
The elephant is unfailingly powerful.
Marvelous. Well, the boat is just tied up round the other side of the yacht, so all we need to do is pop round and I'll wave you off.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, then, take care. Bye.
Bye.
This way, sir.
That was very quick.
That isn't the sound of Mr. de Castel's boat leaving, Mum. It's the sound of a new boat arriving.
But who could it be? Is that a party boat?
No. They're pirates, Mum.
Again? Oh, this is ridiculous. We had pirates when Adrian came for tea.
Ah, but the ones we encountered with Mr. Tchaikovsky were traditional pirates, Mum. These ones are the Pacific Players, a band of ex-actors who hunt the seas, cleansing them of all lacklustre performers.
Goodness, they've grabbed Sebastian.
Let us hope Mr. de Castel can perform as well as he writes, or his career is about to come to a swift and, may I say, bloody end.
Perform? Does he have to act for them?
But of course, Mum. How else are they to judge if he is fabulous enough to live?
Shush! Shush! Be quiet! Shush!
You must survive 3 dramatic trials if you are to live. Act 1. After many years at sea, you are reunited with your long-lost love. What noise do you make when you first set eyes on her?
Or him, Geoffrey.
Or him. Bravo, dear boy. But the audience is not satisfied yet. Act 2. You have eaten a stupendous meal cooked by your lover's family, and all seems to be going well, until you get to dessert. It is your least favourite pudding. Show us how you are feeling when you taste it.
He has to make the noise as well, Geoffrey.
Yes, I suppose so. Although personally, I prefer the medium of dance. Superb. Act 3. Make the noise you would make after walking the plank and hitting the water below. If you can't do it, we can help you.
Boing, boing. Hello? I don't swim. Is there anyone up there? Hello?
Oh, he was was very good, Geoffrey, but you were awful. The worst performance of a pirate I have seen in a long and venerable career. Olivier must be turning in his grave.
No, wait, wait. I'm too beautiful to die.
I'm captain now. Off you go back to your boat, young man. You shall live to act another day.
Oh no. Are we going to be boarded next, Latimer?
No, ma'am. Even the Pacific players know better than to board the Vanessa.
Oh, look. Sebastian has helped Geoffrey into his boat. That is sporting. Whilst Latimer prepares the yacht for travel, can I tell you about Peter's second novel, The Malice, which was launched with cupcakes and cocktails and is now available in the UK and Australia?
You're not doing anything promotional again, are you, ma'am?
No, not at all.
Ah, well, in that case, a message has just arrived from a geek cliché.
Do you mean the geek cliché from Twitter?
The very same, ma'am. He claims to have the answer to your riddle.
What riddle?
The one set by that annoying rival time traveller.
The one you said we shouldn't bother answering because the man was boring and it would be better not to indulge his ego.
Yes, that one, ma'am.
Well, then I suppose we don't need the message.
But we do, ma'am. This way, you can prove yourself superior.
But you just said we shouldn't do that.
That was before we had the answer, ma'am. I didn't want you to feel stupid.
Oh, this is ridiculous. I don't even remember the riddle now.
For a simple shape, I have confounded many. Something inside me is really deadly. I can't be seen, but I have been drawn. I've been around since before you were born. What am I?
And what's the answer?
The answer?
Yes, Latimer.
And our destination?
Yes, Latimer.
Is?
Oh, yes, Latimer.
The answer is...
Ooh! You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman and co-written with Peter Newman. Go to www.teaandjeopardy.com to find previous episodes and www.patreon.com/teaandjeopardy to become a Bless Poppet.